but I think I chose her over myself. I could have been selfish and kept her, but I didn't. I thought she deserved the best. She deserved better than what I could give her.
Welcome to the Telling It Our Way podcast. I'm Becca.
And I'm Allie. In this podcast, we bring you stories by disabled people about disabled people. Stories from the daily lives of self-advocates with intellectual and developmental disabilities.
These are real people with complicated lives. They don't want your pity, and they don't exist to inspire you.
This is not inspiration porn. Hey, Becca. So today we have a really interesting story that we're bringing our listeners. Someone who approached us after hearing our podcast and had a story that they wanted to tell about their experience with pregnancy and adoption.
Yeah, so the format's going to be a little bit different today. Like Allie said, we just have one story, and this is a storyteller who's chosen to remain anonymous. We're just going to call her MJ throughout this episode. We're not going to do a ton of setup before we share MJ's story, but I do want to just give a brief content warning about some of the things we're going to talk about today. We will talk about pregnancy, which means we will also briefly talk about how people get pregnant. We'll also talk about birth, and we'll talk about adoption. So if those are sensitive topics for you, maybe skip this one and join us next time.
Yeah, that's great advice. So also, I wanted to throw, because we are always thinking about what the research says, where mm-hmm. to get the best statistics, I wanted to throw out a really great resource that we will be bringing in some stats from during the course of this episode. And that's the Brandeis-Laurie Institute for Disability Policy. They do a ton of research with folks with intellectual and developmental disabilities, particularly around reproductive justice issues.
That's right. They have something called the Disabled Parent Project, which is where a lot of our research comes from today, but just to give you kind of a baseline of where we're starting with. So what the Brandeis Institute says is that probably about 1 in 5 or about 21% of the births that happen in the country have at least one disabled parent.
That's a lot. I don't think we think of disability and parenting enough. Or when we do think about the combination of disability and parenting, we think of able-bodied parents with disabled children. But the thing is, disabled children grow up, right? Mm-hmm. And when we talk about disability, we're talking about a wide range of what we call in our field body minds. So that could mean physical disability in this case. It could mean psychiatric disability, but it can also mean intellectual or developmental disabilities.
Yeah. And so what we know about, if we're drilling down into thinking about intellectual disability specifically, we know about 1.6, 1.7 million parents in the United States. That's about 2.5% of all of the parents in the United States have some kind of cognitive disability.
And what's interesting is sometimes we have statistics that are all parents with disabilities or all parenting people with disabilities. And then sometimes we have statistics that are specifically about people with intellectual or developmental disabilities. But one thing that we found from the Laurie Institute at Brandeis is that many people with disabilities have delayed prenatal care, experience preterm birth and low birth weight, and they're more likely than an able-bodied parent to do so.
Right. And we'll talk a little bit more about what are some of the challenges and barriers for disabled parents or disabled pregnant people after we hear MJ's story. But for now, I think we really just want to share what MJ has to say with all of you.
Hello, I'm MJ. I consider myself to be a creative person. People say I have a bubbly personality, and I think that's pretty cool. When I was 20, I had a best friend, let's call him S. He helped me open up and be more social and just helped me feel more secure about myself in general. S was my best friend. He hung out with me almost every day and we would have different plans like movies, listening to music, we'd play video games. We had so much planned every week, and even when I was off at summer camp, he'd send me letters saying he missed me and updating me on what's going on at home. On my birthday, he wanted to celebrate that I turned 21. We had a party, and then things happened. I didn't think anything of that night until later on, months later, when I found out I was pregnant. I was at my apartment when I found out. My whole stomach sank. I never had to think of something like this before. It was a very surreal feeling. So for the longest time, I was lying on the floor crying. Not because I was sad that I was pregnant, but because it was a lot of emotions to deal with when you hear news, any kind of news. I just thought to myself, I can barely take care of myself. There are times I forget to eat and shower. So how could I take care of someone else if I couldn't take care of myself? I didn't think I could raise a child. A lot of other people didn't think I could handle it either, and that hurt to think about, because I felt they didn't think I was capable or strong enough. I felt that a child deserves more than I could give at the time. But when the topic of abortion came up, I didn't want to go that route. I'm actually a child of adoption. My story worked out, and I thought she deserved a story too. I went through an agency and started to meet families. We met with this one couple, and they had already adopted a child. I loved their story, and I got all my hopes up. That's kind of an issue I have. I tend to put all my eggs in a basket, my emotions, and think, oh my gosh, this is going to be great. And they ended up rejecting me. I was devastated because it felt like they didn't like me as a person. I was so ready to throw in the towel and just give up. I had one more potential couple to interview with. They seemed really great from the booklet. The pictures were amazing and their story was good. When I met them in person, they were amazing. They got me a present. It was an iPod filled with all the Beatles songs. I'm a very big 60s fan and the Beatles are my favorite. They read my bio and they picked out things from it and it was great. They actually wanted to know me as a person. After that, I'm like, that went really well, but I didn't want to get my hopes up. So when I arrived home from that meeting, an hour or so later, I get a call from my agent and she's like, they loved you. They thought you were amazing. And I'm like, you know what? Let's just go with it. Let's do it. So I picked them and I'm so glad I picked them. I had a friend who spent that whole summer I was pregnant with me. She had me living with her because she didn't think that having someone who was so close to labor should be alone. I didn't make my due date, so they were going to induce labor. They gave me a pamphlet and we read online all these things to do to induce labor. One of the things was blowing up balloons. We bought so many balloons and we filled the entire living room with balloons because it was suggested. Then another thing was spicy food. So we had a whole Mexican spicy food night, just gorging on tons of spicy food. It was really awesome that she was trying to help me. Another thing was swings. So we'd just hang out at the park and swing. It was a great summer, and it was one I will never forget, and I will forever cherish. So I was with this friend. It was a rainy day. You know how most stories start out. It was a dark, dreary day. But I started feeling pains, and I'm like, oh my gosh. And she was the one who drove me to the hospital. I was texting my mom saying, Mom, I'm in labor. And she's like, are you sure? I'm like, yes, Mom, I'm in labor. I need you to meet me at the hospital. The adoptive parents were there the entire time. The doctors let them cut the umbilical cord. The hospital allowed them to be in the delivery room, which was really great. My mom and dad were in the room as well. I'm told S came, but he didn't see me. He did go and visit her, our daughter. He hasn't talked to them or me recently since her birth, and he hasn't seen her since that day. It's been 11 years. I see my daughter 4 times a year. My favorite visits are when we meet at a hotel halfway between where they live and where we live. We go there for Christmas, and we always get breakfast and exchange gifts and catch up. It's always great. She refers to me as her special mom, which is a great title. They also adopted another kid. I know he isn't ours, but I still see him as ours, and we don't treat him any differently. We get him gifts, and my mom is still his grandmother as well. We try to include him in everything. When I gave her up for adoption, I got criticized a lot. Why would you give up your child? I could never give up my own blood. But I think I chose her over myself. I could have been selfish and kept her, but I didn't. I thought she deserved the best. She deserved better than what I could give her. I feel like her adoption helped me understand that I'm more capable than what people make me out to be, which in turn made me think I wasn't capable of things. This whole situation was a huge growing experience, and I feel like you shouldn't think that just because you have disabilities, you should put yourself down. With the right support system and the right friends, you can overcome obstacles. You can do what you want. You can be strong. I feel like if somebody else was in my position, I feel like I'd hope they'd know that it's okay that you aren't alone, that it is okay to have adoption as an option.
So there's so much to unpack about MJ's story, mm-hmm. and the fact that she's so candid about her experiences with pregnancy in the hospital and then with this decision that she made to have an adoption and to have an open adoption. I think I'm really grateful to hear this story. But I also just wanted to highlight some of the places that were just so humorous. So we had the opportunity to meet MJ in person and to hear her story a couple times and get to know her a little bit. And she's hilarious. Mm-hmm. And this image that she gives us that I think is so relatable of being more than 40 weeks pregnant and trying to get that labor started and the things that she did to try to get that labor started. And I just have this image of the room full of balloons.
Mm-hmm. In the middle of the summer.
In the middle of the summer, trying to induce this labor. It's just so funny.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's so much to unpack about MJ's story. But I really just want to, before we dive into it, think about some of the things that she said kind of right at the end of the story. There. She talks about the lessons she carries away from this pregnancy, this decision, and then her, you know, the 11 years since where she's had this open adoption with her daughter and her daughter's adoptive family. She talks a lot about kind of the lessons she's learned from that, the resiliency that she's learned. She mentions that, you know, there are a lot of assumptions that get made about people with developmental disabilities, about what they are and are not capable of, and that this situation has really highlighted for her that she is capable of more than what she thought she was.
Yeah, and that just the process of going through that, of going through making that decision, highlighted and gave her confidence in her capabilities as a parent. And sometimes we think that when people, quote unquote, give up their child for adoption, which I think is a unfair way to term that, right? Because mm-hmm. It's as if you no longer have that relationship, right? And I think she sees herself as a parent very much so, right? And that she has things that she wants her child to learn from her and from her experience as an adoptee herself.
Right, yeah. So one of the things MJ talked to us about when she was here in the studio recording is that she is really interested in telling adoption stories from all the different sides, right? From as an adoptee, as a parent who has given up a child for adoption, and then eventually she wants her daughter to share her story as well.
And I think as somebody who is a parent, a parent of an adopted kid, right? So I adopted somebody. I think that I'm always looking for those positive stories of adoption. And one of the things she says that's so important is to remember that adopted parents chose you, that you were a choice. And mm-hmm. I think that's a really powerful statement to make.
Yeah. So I think there's just a couple of different areas that we want to kind of unpack a little bit more to give a little bit more context for everyone. And the first of those is around kind of reproductive health care to begin with for people with disabilities, particularly for pregnant people with disabilities.
Yeah. So the Center for American Progress states that Medicaid is a critical source of insurance coverage for people with disabilities. More than 1 in 3 adult Medicaid enrollees under the age of 65 has a disability. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that happens is with something like, let's say, the Hyde Amendment, which is what prohibits funding for early termination of pregnancy. If you're getting Medicaid, you cannot fund an early termination of pregnancy.
Mm-hmm. Right. And add that on top of all of these other kinds of issues that people have in just navigating Medicaid to begin with, right? So there are many professionals who won't accept Medicaid, or you may have difficulty finding a doctor in the first place, and then you add kind of these additional elements on top of that. And we also know, as we mentioned at the top of the show, that women with disabilities experience much higher rates of pregnancy-related complications than the general population, whether that's something like preeclampsia or gestational diabetes or hemorrhage. And also, disabled women just have difficulty accessing reproductive health care to begin with. So there's a study that came out last year that said that nearly 70% of disabled women report barriers to accessing reproductive health care at all. And so that can mean things like finding a provider who can provide them care, you know, even the basic level of care. It can be access to birth control. It could be access to assistive reproductive technologies if they're seeking to become pregnant.
And nearly 50% of people with disabilities are reporting medical mistreatment. So a lot of these barriers are attitudinal barriers.
Yeah, absolutely. And these attitudes kind of double down when we're thinking about developmental disability and intellectual disability. We've mentioned this before, but we know, for example, that women with developmental disabilities are less likely to have preventative reproductive screenings like mammograms, and so are more likely to have breast cancer diagnoses that are made at much farther advanced stages than the typical population.
You know, I just completed a book project about the intersection of disability and pregnancy, and I talked with several disabled people who had been pregnant in the last 5 to 7 years about their experience. None of these people identified as having an intellectual or developmental disability. That's a separate project. Mm-hmm. But even without those identifications, these disabled people, more than almost half of them, had the state get involved when they were following their delivery because the state and the hospital were concerned that they were incapable of parenting, mm-hmm. right? So they had social workers in their hospital rooms. So the hospital often is not a safe place because you're experiencing those attitudinal barriers again of assumptions about incompetency when it comes to parenting.
Yeah, so this is the other area that I think we should talk about here when we're reflecting on MJ's story are some of the biases that exist around disabled parents and particularly parents with intellectual disabilities. And so we know, for example, that up to 80% of parents with intellectual disabilities will have an encounter with Child Protective Services that means that their child is temporarily or permanently removed from their home.
And think about the other side of that, which if you're somebody with intellectual disability who wants to parent, would you even be considered as an adoptive parent,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah. So the ARC actually has, the ARC of America has a whole bunch of resources for parents with intellectual and developmental disabilities, including some resources, and Brandeis has these as well, around what are your rights if you want to become an adoptive parent and you have a disability? You have the right to access those systems the way that anybody else does.
So what's really interesting is the ARC says they don't leave us sort of hopeless and thinking, well, the system really stinks and there's nothing we can do about it, right? But the ARC actually gives us some really helpful things that we can do and advocate for if you are a disabled person seeking options for parenting, or if you know someone who is, right? Here are some things that I think are a pretty good list in terms of what we can start looking for to support all kinds of families. And so one of those things is in-home visits to teach parenting skills and to assess parenting competency. I think we, especially in the United States, have this idea that parenting should come naturally. Mm-hmm. And everyone I know who has a toddler does not think that parenting comes naturally at all, right? I think everybody can use support when it comes to parenting. But to have in-home visits to teach parenting skills is one of those things that the ARC says would be really helpful.
Yeah, so what I really like about this is the ARC's position statement on parenting with an intellectual disability is that they make it really clear that the barriers that are faced by parents with intellectual disabilities are systemic. Right? It is not this idea that people with intellectual disabilities are inherently unable or incapable of being parents, right? In fact, they're saying the exact opposite. And there's actually some research to back this up. You know, it's probably not surprising that there isn't a ton of research about parents with intellectual disabilities, but there is this one particular study from the late 90s by Booth and Booth, where they interviewed 30 adults who had grown up with parents with intellectual disabilities. And so what they found was that these children who grew up into adults had pretty normal childhoods. They had good relationships with their parents, and there wasn't this evidence. You know, there's often this fear that exists that if a person with an intellectual disability becomes a parent, their child will just become their caregiver, right? And what this study found was that wasn't the case, right? So these were children who were just raised in loving homes, right? And so having an intellectual disability doesn't immediately disqualify you from being a good parent. And I think the ARC really underlines that too, saying if we get people assistance, if we get people skills training, if we get people coordination in the service system, then people with intellectual disabilities can be wonderful parents.
I mean, other things that they say that would be great, and this would be great for all families, is transportation, right? If people had access to reliable transportation, playgroups for children and parents, crisis intervention services, things that are actually already exist in our social services, but we just need to coordinate them thinking about parenting in mind.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, going back to MJ's story, I think what she says at the end here is that if you have the right support system and the right friends, you can do what you want in your life. You can pursue the kind of life that you want. And I think that's what it boils down to for all of us. But, you know, that requires a little bit more coordination, a little bit more intention when we're thinking about parenting with an intellectual disability. But I think, ultimately, that's what we all need, is the right support system for us.
And, you know, I think one of the reasons why we haven't coordinated services for people with intellectual or developmental disabilities who want to become parents is because we have this history of forcibly sterilizing people with IDD and DD in this country. And it's something that you and I both teach about a lot. Mm-hmm. It's something that has gotten a little bit more attention recently. If people have been hearing about the historic case called Buck v. Bell.
Mm-hmm.
So in that case, we have a young woman named Carrie Buck, and she is somebody who becomes pregnant while institutionalized. And her mother was somebody who had also been institutionalized. And so Carrie is the product of a pregnancy that could or could not have been a coerced sexual circumstance. We don't know everything. Mm-hmm. And Carrie Buck gives birth, and the case goes to the Supreme Court because they want to sterilize Carrie Buck so that she doesn't give birth again. And very famously, Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes says in his official argument for the coerced sterilization of disabled people, he says, three generations of imbeciles is enough.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And we have yet to overturn Buck v. Bell.
Yeah, right. I mean, I think we think a lot about controlling the reproductive choices of people with disabilities as a way to, quote unquote, protect them, right? Or as a way to keep people safe. And ultimately, what that is just denying people of their bodily autonomy, right? People with intellectual and developmental disabilities have just as much right to make decisions about having and raising children as anybody else.
And, you know, I think as a result of that eugenics era where we made that decision in Buck v. Bell, not we, Becca and I, but the United States. It wasn't us. Made that decision. I mean, people with intellectual disabilities were considered so dangerous because their disabilities were, especially if you were a highly functioning disabled person, your disability was invisible. And so you could be somehow passing on some sort of cognitive disability without anybody knowing it. So it was considered a menace to society. And that was one of the things that we were most scared about, was the invisibility of this disability.
Mm-hmm. And I think the kind of fear around disability, that kind of isolation that existed for many people with disabilities, it's still exists today, and we're still feeling the waves of that today. And so something like MJ sharing her story gives us insight into what the actual lives of people with disabilities are like, and not these boogeymen that we've created in our head over the last 100 years.
I know, I'm really grateful to MJ for sharing her story today.
Yeah, and we just want to leave y'all with a couple of resources in case you want to learn a little bit more. As we mentioned, the Disabled Parenting Project, which is part of the National Research Center for Parents with Disabilities at Brandeis University. And then if you're interested in learning more about adoption in the U.S., AdoptUSKids.org is a great place to start.
Before we end, we want to thank our contributor MJ, our associate producer Connor Smenner, our intern Ava Gottschalk, and our Telling It Our Way advisory board members Jarita Fox, Quinn Thomas, and Gavin Daly.
And special thanks to WGTE and our producer Chris Pfeiffer. To access transcripts for our show and any other show notes, please visit WGTE.org/ourway.
I'm Allie Day.
And I'm Becca Monteleone. And you've been listening to Telling It Our Way.
WGTE. Voices around us.
WGTE is supported in part by the American Rescue Plan Act funds, allocated by the City of Toledo and the Lucas County Commissioners, and administered by the Arts Commission.